Coming live from the picket line, it's the Hand Plus Podcast, where each week I, Joe Furkey, and my co-host Tristan Mayer break down this week in streaming, kind of give people an update. Hey, this is what you should be watching. This is what we watch. This is the news. This is what's coming out. Kind of, you know, there's so many streaming services. Feels like everyone has, you know, has current access to 5, 6, 7 streaming services. And it's like, what should I be watching? That's what we're here for. Forgot to change my name at the bottom. That is last week's name. Has no bearing on anything happening this week. I might change it while Tristan's talking. Keep it a little up to date. But Tristan, you had a little bit more of an active week in streaming than I did, Tristan. I'm going to ask you the question I ask you every week. How is your week in streaming?
Yeah, I watched a lot. Every time we have a week where we say, you know what, not much came out. I don't know what we're doing here. We get a week where everything seems to drop at once, you know. So, yeah, I watched a lot of stuff, a couple of holdover stuff from a few weeks ago, but I definitely had a chance this week to catch up on a lot of things. So I'm really excited to talk about some stuff this week. I had some stuff that really impressed me that I had like kind of lower expectations for, and I also had stuff that really let me down. So I can't wait to talk about all of those different sides of streaming today.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about it. You know, let's save the big topic, the one that's going to affect streaming and everything else entertainment-wise, for the end of the show, and that is the writer's strike is on. We'll talk a little bit about that and what we think the big effects can be at the end.
Yeah, I definitely have a lot of notes on that. We're going to get into like some of the demands and some of the stuff that I think is really holding up the process, because if you look, you can get a list of all the demands and what was met and what wasn't. So judging by that, I've made a couple of notes here on what I think are going to be the big holdout debates over the next couple of months here. So it'll be a good conversation. Yeah, we'll get into the politics of how it's affecting streaming specifically, how streaming, I think, is a big, huge proponent of why this strike even happened in the first place. So that'll be a great conversation for the end of the show.
Yep. All right. Well, let's kick it off with Hulu. Not much here to talk about this week. However, we did get a little bit of news for the King of the Hill continuation, I guess. I don't know if whatever comes out, they're going to call like whatever the next season of King of the Hill was, or if they're going to call it something else like King of the Hill : but Pamela Adlon, the voice of Bobby Hill, revealed in an interview that there's going to be a pretty decent sized time jump, and that Bobby Hill, who was basically a middle schooler on the original animated show, is going to be a young adult in the continuation. So very curious to see what they do with that. I love King of the Hill. It's a show I never really watched as it came out, but I found it in reruns, and I really enjoy it. I've turned a couple other people onto it. It's just a show about this kind of just family, Hank Hill and his family in small town Arlen, Texas. But Tristan, did you ever watch King of the Hill? Do you have any thoughts on them doing a time jump for them when they bring it back?
Yeah, no, I mean, that show got first announced, we questioned, oh, is there going to be a time jump? Are they just going to essentially pick up where they left off, or are they going to bring it to the modern times? And I think this is a good choice. I feel like the perspective that King of the Hill brings to TV is something that, honestly, I feel like is lacking a little bit, you know, and it feels like this could be a great time for King of the Hill to come in and really have its audience. You know, I feel like there's an audience out there that really is demanding for, like, that type of content and that type of characters to be on screen. So I think that this is going to be a really successful show, and I hope that the time jump gives them a chance to comment on modern issues, you know, because I know the audience is going to be big for that. It's probably going to be a conservative leaning audience, so I wonder how they're going to deal with the commentary. You know, how do they talk about Trump? How do they talk about different things like that when they know their audience is probably leaning that direction themselves? It'll be an interesting show to watch, because I just don't know how that show modernizes into the current audience and into the current world. It's going to be a fascinating one to check out.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see what someone like Hank Hill's thoughts are on, like, the Trump era of politics and modern era of politics.
Yeah, and this is a show that won't shy away from that either. You know they're going to bring that stuff up at some point in some jokes or some lines somewhere.
Yeah, I can definitely, like, there are certain characters, like, you know where they stand, and then there's other characters where I'm like, what take are they going to have on things? So, like, Dale Gribble is a character I feel like is going to go off the reservation as far as thoughts and opinions, but I'm kind of at least interested in seeing how it plays out. But yeah, that's pretty much all there was for Hulu. It was pretty light Hulu week this week. You ready to move over to Amazon?
Yeah, I'm ready to move on to Amazon. They got a big release for them, at least on their eyes.
Yeah, they have a show out called called Citadel. I have not watched it. The trailer, the premise, everything looks like, oh, this is like a big budget movie, but then you find out it's a show. Tristan, you watched it. What is your thought on Citadel?
Yeah, and it has the budget of a movie too. The budget for this show, Joe, hold on to your seat, because it was $300 million for 6 episodes.
Wow.
It makes it one of the most expensive television shows of all time. Amazon seems to be going for that record on purpose or something like that, you know, because they have this and they have Rings of Power. And yeah, it's a spy thriller. It kind of is in the vein of like the Bourne Ultimatum or those kind of thrillers that are like conspiratorial thrillers. You're not quite sure who to trust and those kind of things. It has elements of Mission Impossible. One of the creators of the show, Josh Applebaum, he has a writing credit for Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, and a couple of other movies that are not quite as good as that one. But yeah, this is an interesting one because it has some production value and you can see that a bit on the screen. But when you hear $300 million and you hear Russo brothers are very much involved in this, they were very involved in it from what you hear from behind the scenes. They kind of overstepped themselves and kind of took control of this series themselves and stepped over the showrunners and kind of like turned it into a much bigger and more bloated project than it was intended to be. And you can honestly see all of that, you know, for all of that drama and all of that money, all you got was like this, the most generic spy show you could think of, you know, that it reminded me of not, it's trying to go for the Bourne Ultimatum, Bourne Identity kind of feel, but it gave me the 355 feel, you know, you remember that trailer from back in the day, like a January, February spy thriller where you watch it and you're like, all right, you know, it was fine. And then you forget about it by halfway through the year, you know, and I can't believe they spent this much money on this show. It's probably the biggest waste of money I've ever seen in terms of like a movie or a show before. Cause at least Rings of Power, like they spent a lot of money, but every frame of that show looks like insanely beautiful and gorgeous. And you can see the money on the screen in every single shot, you know, and this, there's moments where it shines, but none of the action is very thrilling or exciting. None of the drama is interesting. None of the performances are very good. Richard Madden, who played Robb Stark on Game of Thrones, is the lead here, and zero charisma kind of performance from this guy. I don't know what to get from him. I'm not going to finish this show, and I'm really embarrassed for Amazon, honestly, that they spent so much on this show that is just such a nothing show, and it's already got renewed for season 2 before it aired, you know, so now they're going to have to go through this all again for another season, which, I don't know, we'll see what the numbers are for this, because it feels kind of in Amazon's wheelhouse, you know, up like the Jack Ryan Reacher kind of crowd, but I just don't see this engaging, even to the level of like a Reacher, you know, so yeah, I don't know what they're doing here.
So do you think it's more Richard Madden being kind of non-charismatic that's killing this show? Like if Chris Pine or someone like that was the lead, do you think there's a chance that it's a better show? Like, obviously, I think obviously it'd be a better show, but do you think it'd be the show they were hoping it would be if they had someone who was more charismatic as the
lead? It would be much more compelling to watch, you know, because a great performance and a really compelling actor can drag you through some weaker storylines. But I feel like what really hurt this one here is that they tried to polish it so much. They really tried to craft it into like this really sheen spy thrill that it's like feels very much like a studio movie that was made to be a hit to the point where nothing really works. It's just kind of like doing stuff that was cool in other movies, but nothing really independent of itself. You know, I watched the first episode or so, and I was like, there was nothing about it that grabbed me and said, this is the unique thing about this show that I got to catch on to, you know? And the Russo brothers have done action stuff for Netflix that isn't great movies necessarily, but they have like cool action sequences and like stuff that I enjoy about like Extraction and things like that. But this had nothing to attach to. And yeah, better actor would have made it more watchable, but I feel like this show is just, it's so meticulously crafted to work that it doesn't work, you know?
Yeah,
you can feel the beats before they're coming and you can see the scenes before they're over and that kind of thing.
Too many cooks in the kitchen, kind of where everyone had their own take on how things should go, and that it just,
yeah, and that's what apart. It sounds like from the drama behind the scenes of it, that they had this show going and then all of a sudden the Russo brothers decided to step up and put themselves on set and be more involved in the production and reshoot some things and change some things around. And it feels like that. It feels like a couple of different ideas that nobody was able to do what they wanted to with.
All right. So basically what you're saying is don't watch Citadel on Amazon Prime.
No. And, you know, Amazon has plenty of these shows like this that are better. You know, I don't necessarily love this genre all the time, but like even the one with Chris Pratt, like Terminal something, like it was better
Terminalist,
than,
yeah.
Yeah, the one with Michael B. Jordan, that was actually better than this. This feels like a huge budget version of those shows, but just worse than all of them.
Yeah. All right. You ready to move over to Netflix?
Let's go with Netflix.
Netflix. So what we learned, King of the Hill is coming out. We're looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it. And don't watch Citadel on Amazon Prime. Deadline, I believe. Yeah, Deadline reported this week that Adam McKay has a new movie coming to Netflix. It stars Robert Pattinson, Amy Adams, Robert Downey Jr., Forrest Whitaker, and Daniel Deadwyler. It's called Average Height, Average Build. And essentially the premise is, Robert Pattinson is playing a serial killer who enlists a lobbyist, played by Amy Adams, to change the laws that will allow him to get away with murder more easily. Robert Downey Jr. is a retired cop who won't give up on investigating the murders, and the killer tries to prevent him from dogging his trail now that he's hung up his gun. The serial killer turns himself in, or the serial killer turns himself into a cause celeb, whatever the hell that means. A Mr. Smith goes to Washington figure, shielding his true motives. So feels like there's a lot going on with this movie. Definitely going to take on the whole like politics and lobbyists. And I feel like Adam McKay, who's had made a lot more political movies the last few years, and kind of just going more like, what's the most absurd take I can go with, like a guy paying off lobbyists, and that's a serial killer, making it easier to get away with killing people.
Yeah, I'm curious about this one because that premise does sound fun, and the cast really sounds fun. You know, that you hear that premise, and then you give me the cast, and I feel like the cast elevates that, because you can see Robert Downey Jr. pulling off that role, and especially you can see Robert Pattinson being like that American Psycho, cold, kind of charismatic front performance. I think he could pull that off really well, and that's what makes me so excited for this, because Adam McKay has been on a miss streak for a while, I feel like, but I think The Big Short was a big hit for him, and I wonder if this can go back to more like that and less like Don't Look Up, but the premise is so big and absurd that it feels like it's going to be more Don't Look Up than anything else, you know, so I'm curious about this one. I've also heard that he was shopping this around at Sundance this year, and every other studio was saying no, they didn't want to do it, they weren't interested. And Netflix was the one that said yes. So I wonder why they were passing on this, because the cast is big, but people must not be confident in the premise or confident in Adam McKay to deliver something successful. And Netflix has had a hit with him, Don't Look Up. I didn't like it, but it was nominated for some Oscars. You know, it was a very well-viewed movie on Netflix. So I think they're going to have a hit here, especially with this cast. But yeah, I'm curious, but I'm not quite optimistic right now, just based off of Adam McKay's recent work.
Yeah, Vice I saw in theaters, and that movie, I feel like if he makes this movie, I guess, simple and doesn't try to make it more style over substance. Because I haven't watched Don't Look Up, but I watched Vice, and I feel like that's where Vice failed, is it kept trying to do all the extra stuff that, what was his first... Big Short. That The Big Short kind of needed to do to explain to all of these overcomplicated processes that Vice didn't. It's just like, hey, here's Dick Cheney as he is, and it kept trying to add all this extra stuff onto it that it didn't need. So I feel like if he dials it back a little bit, hopefully he can kind of get it going in the right direction.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We'll definitely be watching it once this eventually,
yeah,
at some point comes out. He's still imagine having to write the script, so who knows when that'll happen. And yeah, I'm excited for it when it does come out. I wonder if it'll be another Oscar. You know, he seems to be like a shoo-in for Oscar nominations, even for his worst work. So I think this is going to be another one to place your Oscar bets on.
Yeah, I agree. All right, and there was something on Netflix you watched this week. You watched the new Power Rangers movie that came out a couple weeks ago. I believe it came out on 420. They knew what they were doing.
Yeah, the perfect release date for it. Unfortunately, I was occupied with some other activities on 420, but I didn't watch Power Rangers on 420, but I watched it this week, and it was a good time. I don't have the level of nostalgia for Power Rangers that I feel like the primary intended audience for this did. You know, that would be somebody who watched it every day as a kid and remembers all the characters and all the plot lines and is going to get nostalgic for all the classic lines. And there were a couple of moments where I definitely felt like, oh, they're quoting something that I don't remember or things like that. Mm-hmm. But I had a lot of charm. There's a lot of charm to it. It definitely feels like a Power Rangers movie. The dialogue is cheesy. The effects are extreme level, low budget. I wish they would have given them a bit more of a budget, you know, because this is like their big comeback special. It would have felt like a bit more of like a globe-trotting thing where they had more sets and more villains and a bigger kind of story, because the story does feel kind of small. It's more about, isn't it cool to see these actors back together as the Power Rangers again, more so than, anything else. So I had a great time with it. It definitely is one to throw on if you're nostalgic for Power Rangers in any way at all, but it's not going to be one where you're like, oh, I watched a couple episodes of Power Rangers, I remember the characters kind of, and you're going to watch it and say, that was all right, but you're not going to like be head over heels on it. And I feel like that's the biggest thing. It's aiming only for the biggest fans of Power Rangers. And as someone who played with the toys and watched the episodes here and there, I enjoyed it, but I was not, you know, enthralled by watching it.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Power Rangers was a thing that was on when I was a kid. I don't really remember anything about it. I don't really remember any of the characters' names. So I feel like it was just something that wasn't made for me. It was a thing. It was nostalgia bait for something I have no nostalgia for. So I was like, I just didn't have interest. And I thought about watching it for this podcast, but I felt like I know what it's going to be. Hey, if you grew up and you loved Power Rangers as a 90s kid, you're going to love this. And if you didn't love Power Rangers as a 90s kid, you're not going to love this. So I felt like if I was just going to watch it to review it for the show, it was going to be a waste of time. I knew what my review would be before I even watched it.
Yeah, and you probably would have been right, because that was basically what I got from it too.
Yeah. All right, yeah, that was all we had for Netflix. It was like a little bit. We didn't have much in any one kind of streaming service this week, but we had a little bit in all of them. Tristan, you watched Mrs. Davis on Peacock. This is the Betty Gilpin show, if I remember right, where she plays the nun.
Oh yeah, this is an interesting one. It's co-created by Damon Lindelof, who did Lost and The Leftovers and Watchmen and all these high concept kind of shows, and this is pretty high concept. It's called Mrs. Davis because it's the name of the AI. It's a show about an AI that essentially controls the entire world. It creates your jobs for you. It controls everything. It's based off of, you know, algorithms and you know, math and preconceived ideas of how people behave, and it's about all these odd characters that exist within this AI-controlled world. Yeah, Joe mentioned the lead character is this nun who has this like very intense fixation on Jesus Christ. You know, a sexual bordering on sexual relationship, if not past the border, with Jesus, and it feels like this very odd, strange world. And if you've seen Damon Lindelof's other stuff, he loves to just throw weird at you for the first couple episodes, and you got to kind of like have the faith to play along and understand that it's going to make sense, you know. And like if you watch the first episode of Watchmen, and or maybe it's the second episode, and you see all these squids fall out of the sky randomly in the middle of the day, and people got to start mopping it up and acting like it's this casual thing, like, oh yeah, we're just mopping up the squids as usual. And if you're in the audience, you're sitting there like, what, they're just mopping up squids? But you got to kind of, you know, have faith in the story that it's eventually going to tell you why they're mopping up squids, you know. And for right now, it feels like it's throwing out all those pitches. It's like, oh, what's this crazy thing the AI is doing? Or what's this weird relationship between the characters? And, you know, and then they kind of pull it back a little bit and they push it forward. And I'm wondering if they're actually going to pay any of this stuff off, because right now it's still at the really weird phase where they're just asking questions and doing weird stuff with the AI. And it's very funny. Like, it's more on the humorous side than the drama side, like painting these very absurd scenarios of an AI and going to an AI for like emotional support, and what would an AI say if you were saying like you want to kill yourself, or those kind of things. And it's very funny, it's very dark, but I'm still waiting to see how it's going to come together to be like an actual thematically compelling show that has questions and answers. And I'm hoping that it does, because I've doubted Lindelof before, and he ends up paying it off in the end. Like Watchmen, The Leftovers are two of my favorite shows I've ever watched, and those are things where at some point I said, does he know what he's doing here? And then he ends up pulling out one of the better episodes of TV history by the end of the season. So we'll see how it goes. But as of now, I'm cautiously enjoying this a lot, but I'm having my guard up. You know, I don't want to be hit the end of the season and being like, I don't know what we were doing here, because nothing was answered or explained or even asked in any interesting way.
All right. Yeah, it's definitely a show. I've seen commercials for it, obviously. Like I said, it's one that looks interesting to me.
I think you would enjoy it, because it honestly feels like Big Brother or something, you know, like people are kind of in a house type of situation. It's not really in a house, but it's like in an AI that controls you, you know. You always got these eyes on you, so I feel like you'd enjoy it.
All right, cool. Ready to move over to Apple TV, talk about something I think you might have watched last week and we just didn't get to it.
Yeah, I'm ready. What do we got?
Looks like you watched both Schmigadoon and Tetris.
Yeah, I'll start out with Tetris, because that's probably the more talked about movie here. Taron Egerton plays I can't even remember the character's name now, but he's the guy who essentially goes to Russia to get the rights to develop Tetris in America. So he's not really the guy who creates Tetris, but he's the guy who goes to Russia and gets the rights to Tetris to bring it to the rest of the world. And Tetris ends up being, you know, obviously a huge hit that kind of shapes and changes gaming forever and is still a primary part of gaming. New Tetris games come out all the time. So I feel like in the era of video game movies being everywhere, this is a unique take. When I hear Tetris movie, I think, oh, are they going to be adapting blocks? You know, like, what is this going to...
Then you realize it's going to be like that College Humor sketch from like 15 years ago. If you haven't checked that out, that's a great sketch.
IGN April Fool's Day videos and things like that. And you're like, oh, but it's about the making of. And I think it's compelling because you do get this story about, you know, it's set right at the peak of the Cold War. And there's a lot of tension between the America and the United States. And Turn Edgen is like this super conky, confident American coming in to Russia at the wrong time, and they escalate that to crazy heights. You know, there's car chases and there's like action sequences that surely did not happen in the real story, but they add to the fun of it. It reminded me of Argo a bit, where you're like, the core story here is cool, but they definitely wanted to Hollywood it up quite a lot here. And I kind of wish they would have just made the actual story, because I would have liked to hear that, you know, more than just a Cold War action thriller that has Tetris going on, you know. But I think this is much more of a Hollywood production. It was getting some Oscar buzz before it came out, but I think his performance is good, but not to that level of good. You know, it's not going to be on a Leonardo DiCaprio level or something like that. So I don't think it's going to be getting any Oscar love, but it tells you a compelling story, a good look at the behind the scenes of video games. I feel like now that video games are taking over the world, it's important to appreciate what goes into making those happen, you know. But definitely a good watch, and you don't have to know anything about Tetris or video games to like this. You know, it talks about video games and video game culture and stuff like that, but you can like it as just kind of like a business / Cold War thriller where you have both the boardroom scenes where they're yelling at each other like something from Air, and you also have like Bridge of Spies, Berlin Wall drama, where it's people with Russian accents are talking about how you can't be trusting anyone here, American, and things like that. So a fun merging of dad movies. So if you're a fan of dad movies, you'll get a kick out of this one. And I enjoyed it. It's not going to be on the top of my list, but it was a solid watch for sure. And I had a good time with it and learned a good amount about Tetris and apparently car chases over video games.
Yeah, makes sense. Car chases everywhere. All right. And what about Schmigadoon?
This is actually the second season for Schmigadoon. I talked about the original show, I believe, at some variation of this podcast back in the day. But this starts Keegan-Michael Key from obviously Key and Peele, and you also have Cecily Strong from SNL, and they're the two leads here. They play a couple who's at a couple's retreat in the woods. They're having very bad couples problems, and they wander off by themselves and end up in a magical town called Schmigadoon, where everybody sings and dances, and the whole town acts like it's a 1950s musical. And the guy hates it, of course. He says, this is so annoying. I hate musicals. This is so dumb. Why is everybody singing? But Cecily Strong is like getting in touch with her teenage girl self and starting to love the musical romance of it and things like that. So this is the second season. The first season was very much off of like the Sondheim, you know, big dance musicals that are very bright and colorful. And this season is getting much more sensual into kind of like the lovey musicals and the stuff like that. And so I'm enjoying the change of tone. But yeah, if you have any love for like Broadway musicals of any kind, this is such a blast, because the songs are like sometimes parodies or tributes to different types of Broadway music and performances. And you're going to get all these references and all these little tiny things. But even without that, it's just like a fun, goofy parody, you know, because the whole time Key hates musicals. So if you're someone who hates musicals, you can connect to that character and how he hates everything that's going on around him, you know. So I had a blast with this, and I hope more people watch it, because it's a really small scale show on Apple TV Plus, and I hope it gets a third season, because I'm loving it so far.
All right, I'm not gonna lie and sit here and be like, oh yeah, I'll definitely check it out. It does not feel like my kind of thing at all. So am I gonna watch Schmigadoon? No, but hey, I'm gonna be honest with you and say I'm not gonna watch Schmigadoon.
Look, you know, I feel like I would appreciate parts of it, but I don't feel like the primary audience for Schmigadoon here. You know, maybe watch it with your girlfriend. You know, it's a nice girlfriend watch.
Yeah. I don't even know if that's her thing. Like, I don't really know if she's even cares for musicals. I'll have to ask her when I talk to her in a minute. But also, one final thing on one of these small streaming services you watch is Paramount Plus, Scream 6. Who would have thought Scream we'd get a sixth one and a seventh one, apparently, but here we are.
Yeah, I mean, this is a franchise that can never die, much like the Ghostface character itself. It always comes back, you know? So it seems like this revival is here to...
Ghostface returned.
Somehow it seems like this revival is here to stick, though, you know, because they came back but Scream 4, it didn't really do super well, and it seemed like all the franchises must be dead. But then Scream 5 came back last year, it was only a year ago, and revived the whole franchise. It was a big financial hit, and this one came out, and it was an even bigger hit. This is one of the biggest hits for the entire franchise so far, financially-wise. And critical, I think it's doing did really well, too. It was better reviewed than the previous Scream, and yeah, it looks like now this is going to be a yearly thing while they can still milk it, you know. And I really like this one, though. It changes up the setting, which I think helps a lot. It's not set in the classic small-town America. They change it up and bring it to New York because Tara and a lot of the main characters are now college students. And I think what really made this interesting is they change up the perspective quite a lot. You know, they're not really trying to do the traditional Scream thing. And from the very opening sequence, they subvert your expectations, and that feels like the commentary they're trying to bring in here is the movies that subvert your expectations, where, you know, it's not The Force Awakens anymore, now we're at The Last Jedi, where things aren't going to go the way you think they're supposed to go, and twists are going to come in the middle of the movie and things like that. So yeah, if you had a great time with the previous Scream, you're going to love this one. But I thought the previous Scream was just okay. It was a solid revival, but it didn't really scare me. It didn't really have any like peak gore scenes or anything like that, and I thought this was a big step up. There's some kill scenes in here that are going to stick with me, some of the best of the franchise. Some great chase sequences. They really make a great use of the setting. You know, there's a great fight in an alley, you know, that wouldn't be able to work in a small town America. But because you're in New York, you can have these cool alley sequences and all of these kind of like dark crevices that would, you know, be in a big metropolitan city. So I had a blast with this, and I hope the rest of the franchise is like this, because if they're getting better and better with each sequel, I'm going to be having a great time, because this was not a perfect movie. I feel like the Ghostface reveal at the end is not my favorite. And there's some times where a character will get stabbed, you know, like 12 times and then just be fine afterwards, you know, and that can get a little ridiculous, you know, especially a movie that's trying to take itself a little bit more seriously than the previous Screams. But yeah, I'm more into this franchise than I was for the previous movie. And now I'm kind of sold on it being a continuous thing. So, yeah, I'm in for this one.
Yeah, especially I feel like if Scream is a thing, I mean, I haven't kept up with it, but if Scream is a thing that commentates or comments on recent horror, I feel like as horror changes and you're getting more of that kind of Hereditary or, you know, those type of horror movies, I think it'd be interesting if it were to slowly veer more in that direction than, like, kind of the 90s slashers that it originally was a take on.
Yeah, and there's even some fun commentary about, like, look, we're not in a trilogy anymore. We're in a franchise. You know, anything can happen. Any character can come in or come out at any time, because now we're a big running franchise and the rules are all kind of changing now. So, yeah, I wonder what the rules are going to be going forward.
Yeah. Awesome. I'm happy that Scream fans are happy, you know?
Yeah, and I'm really impressed by this one. I can't wait to keep watching it again and again. And like I said, a step up for me from the previous one. So I'm in for this.
All right, my other question for you, did you end up finishing Jury Duty?
I did not finish Jury Duty. You want to sing your praises, Joe? Give a little more...
No, I talked about it last week. I finished last week. I just wondered if you had thoughts on the finale. But yeah, I talked about the finale last week. I'm hoping it gets a second season. I haven't heard anything so far. I'm slowly trying to get the word out, letting everyone I know that I think would like it to watch it. And hopefully if it gets enough viewers that they will greenlight a season two.
I heard coverage about the show, believe it or not, on NPR, so I feel like I have not heard any other freebie coverage on the radio of any kind, so maybe they're really getting the success out of the show.
Yeah. All right, and now we're going to kick it over to HBO Max. A little bit of news. Warrior Season 3 teaser trailer dropped. I know, Tristan, you've watched Seasons 1 and 2. I have not. The trailer looks great. If you don't know what Warrior is, it's essentially based on the writings of Bruce Lee. He wrote them, you know, obviously before he passed, and there's like rumors and speculation that he had these writings, had this story treatment. He pitched it. The studio passed and said, no, we're not interested, nothing we'd really like to make. They essentially stole them, reworked them, and turned them into the television show Kung Fu. So this is more of, like, I guess, a darker, not darker, but more mature, more realistic R-rated take on that. But Tristan, did you watch that teaser trailer? It's just a quick 30-second teaser. And are you excited for Warrior Season 3?
Yeah, I checked out that quick little teaser, and I'm looking forward to the show. You mentioned it definitely feels just like this big kung fu movie. You know, you're watching it for the epic action, and it has kind of like this mythical level story about, you know, the archetypal characters. But the story is there, but you watch it because the action sequences are just mind-bogglingly impressive. And I feel like this is a show that's kind of slept on, to be honest. Like, it's sure it's getting renewed and talked about, but I don't feel like this show is talked about half as much as it needs to be talked about. This should be talked about on the same level as some of our biggest shows right now, because it's delivering spectacle to the level of like a John Wick movie every week, you know, and it's giving you Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon every week. You know, you don't get that from any other shows right now. So I feel like in an action-oriented time, everyone loves their action movies and everyone loves their streaming shows. Everyone should be watching this. Everybody should be watching this, talking about it. We talk about Succession and the Marvel shows and The Last of Us and, you know, Mandalorian. I hope this gets more views than Mandalorian Season 3. You know, let's push it, and we could beat Mando. You know, nobody watched Mando this year. You know, we can get more than, what, 500 views in an episode?
I think Mando got a little bit more than 500 views an episode.
Probably.
Yeah. All right. But yeah, it is something I'm looking forward to watching. I definitely think I should be watching The Warrior, so I'm going to check it out and hopefully maybe be caught up by the Season 3 finale. So when it's out, I can be like, hey, I'm watching this too. Yeah. All right, and one thing you did watch is a show that tipped me off that there may be changes to HBO Max, and that is Love and Death. When that trailer dropped, I remember, you know, seeing the end, and it said Max Original. I was like, that's interesting. And now here we are, and HBO Max is now just Max. But what were your thoughts on Love and Death? Did they drop the whole season, or is just the first episode, or maybe a batch of episodes? Where are we at?
Yeah, they dropped the first three episodes, and I've seen the first two, so I've still got one episode to catch up on. But spoiler alert, I am going to catch up on it. I'm going to get through myself to watch through this one. You know, I've given some less than positive reviews so far this episode, but I'm happy to give a positive one to this. You have Elizabeth Olsen, of course, famous for being Scarlet Witch. And you have Jesse Plemons from Breaking Bad and all kinds of great stuff, Fargo, and one of the better TV actors, especially working today. And
both Friday Night Lights.
Friday Night Lights. You know, talking about the writer's strike, he had some pretty strong character choices made for his character during the last writer's strike. So, but yeah, he's great in the show. They're both giving really great performances, stuff that I feel like is going to be up for contention and talking about for Emmy time this season. And this is a mini series. It doesn't seem like they're going to be doing any kind of sequel. You know, who's new knows? They seem like they'll will. I'm sure if it gets a lot of money, they'll do Love and Death about some other person or something. But this is based off of a true story. A woman who is kind of like this perfect housewife living in Texas with her perfect house husband and churchgoers and prayerful people. And then all of a sudden, a neighbor ends up chopped up with an axe, and the wife is accused of the murder. And this follows the psychological spiral of this wife and the drama of this marriage instead of behind the scenes of what led up to this brutal axe murder in this small town. If you like stuff like Sharp Objects, you know, this is up in the line of Sharp Objects, up in the line of Mayor of Easttown. You know, it has that small town murder vibe where everyone kind of knows each other, but no one really trusts each other. They all got their kind of interior motives, but it's a much smaller than those scale shows where that felt like it was covering like a whole town. This is much more about like this couple and their spiraling relationship and like, can they trust each other? And I'm curious as they get towards the end, like, who are we going to be empathizing with right now? Because the show seems to really kind of want to empathize with Liz Olsen's character, who ends up being a murderer, a real life killer, it seems like, from at least what I know of the main story. So I'm curious where they end up going with all of this. But so far, I'm very into it, and especially because of the performances. Like I said, for Citadel, if you put great actors in somewhat generic stories, it's going to still be something that's worth watching, you know, because they're going to give you charismatic performances and characters that are compelling, and this feels like that. If you gave this to two lesser actors, it might not be something that I stuck with, but you put two great actors in that lead, and I'm going to be checking it out. I feel like what also helps is that this has sort of a singular vision. Every episode, at least so far, is directed by this woman, Leslie Linka Glider, who has worked on Mad Men and Homeland, and even back in the 90s worked on Twin Peaks. You know, she has a great history of being a prolific TV director across multiple decades of great TV work. So I feel like that gives it some clarity for sure. And you also have David E. Kelly as the writer for every single episode. He has a huge history of, you know, Ally McBeal and Boston Legal and, you know, great legal procedurals that I feel like lead into this show too. So it has a pedigree that I think elevates it more than a lot of the other miniseries that are just written by random house writers. You know, not to talk down to the writers, we'll talk up on the writers in a few minutes, but yeah, this was a great one, and I recommend it for people who are fans of those type of small-scale mystery shows and a great pedigree of creators behind it.
Yeah, definitely one I, you know, looked up my alley. It's based on a true story. My fiance is a big true crime fan, so I feel like it's something I could get her to watch, something we could both watch. So I feel like this weekend I'm definitely going to recommend we watch Love and Death, and then also Moon Age Daydream was something you watched. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Moon Age Daydream is a documentary on David Bowie. It's written, produced, and edited by Brett Morgan. And normally you wouldn't necessarily note that on a documentary, but this is such a specific style that I had to note that. And I feel like the fact that that one vision made this whole thing come together really is shown on the screen, because it's edited with this extreme style and it's very colorful and stylish and feels like, you know, like a David Bowie album come to life. It's very stylistic and cool, and it has this kind of montage editing style that kind of conveys Bowie across all these clips and all of these interviews, and kind of flips kaleidoscope wise through all these different colors and, you know, facial expressions to kind of get into like the persona of Bowie and the kind of like spatial persona of Bowie. It has this kind of like Stanley Kubrick feel or Metropolis feel at points, and I really am enthralled by how odd this documentary is, because you learn a lot about David Bowie as a person and his career, but you also just have this fascinating style. I've never seen a documentary quite like this before that's all acquired clips, but it's all edited in such a strange and fascinating way that makes it feel like this acid trip where you're learning about David Bowie while tripping out a little bit. So yeah, I definitely recommend it for people who are David Bowie fans or people who are just fans of really stylish and cool filmmaking, because I was really, really impressed by this one, and I hope more people watch it.
Yeah. Definitely, you know, I'm not like a massive David Bowie fan or anything like that, but I'm a big documentary fan, so I'll definitely be checking that one out. And you ready to hop over to our final streaming service for the week, Disney Plus?
Yeah, I'm ready. What do we got?
All right, not a whole lot with Disney Plus this week. Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, coming May 17th to Disney Plus. So 2 weeks from today, I believe it's coming to Disney Plus. And we also had an announcement that on May 4th, which is tomorrow, we're getting Rogue Not Quite One, which is going to be a Simpsons kind of short starring Maggie. We really don't know much about it. It looked like just on the poster, it's Maggie getting chased down, chasing somebody down. They usually do one of these Simpsons shorts every May the 4th, it seems, because that's about the only cultural relevancy the Simpsons has. I don't know anyone that watches the Simpsons. I've said before on this podcast, if you're someone who weekly, when the Simpsons episode drops, you're watching it live as it airs for the first time, I will gladly have you on this episode, and we will dedicate an entire episode to interviewing you, because I've never met anyone like that. I don't even know if anyone like that exists. Tristan's, any thoughts on either Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania coming to Disney Plus, or this Maggie Simpsons Star Wars short?
Yeah, I'm sure the Maggie short's not going to be much. You know, they've done these shorts before that are just essentially endless cameos from whatever IP they're riffing on at this point. It doesn't seem like there's much creative juices left in these Simpsons shorts. You know, I don't know. I can't talk about the show, but these shorts definitely feel like Disney bought the Simpsons and they're making us do these random shitty shorts for their streaming platform to boost up their numbers and get some viewership for these little shorts, you know, and that's what they feel like to me. And I'm one of the suckers who's going to probably sit there and watch it anyway, because, oh, it's Star Wars, so I got to watch it and see what it is. You know, so they got me hooked.
Yep.
But yeah, as for Ant-Man and the Wasp, not exactly the best MCU movie. I'll review it We can review it together, I guess, if you end up watching it when it's on Disney Plus. But yeah, I was more of a fan of this than most people. But even as more of a fan, I was still let down by it. There is some great camp and cool visuals. It feels like it's a kind of Star Wars prequel esque movie where there's like these huge CGI battles that feel so computer generated that they're like emotionally distant. You can't even like connect to what's happening, you know. And I feel like it doesn't necessarily make the most out of Ant-Man's powers either. You know, when he's in a tiny world where everything is shrunk, does it even matter that you can shrink? You know, like there's not a lot of scenes where they're making the most out of his powers and his visual scale and that kind of thing. So it was an all right movie. There's obviously some drama behind the scenes, a good amount of drama behind the scenes regarding Kang and Jonathan Majors, but he's good in this movie. But you know, we'll see what happens from there.
Yeah, I agree. And then also, there's something else you watched on Disney Plus, and that's Peter Pan and Wendy. I've seen high praise for this movie, but I've also seen people be like, yeah, it's kind of mediocre, and I was curious where you stood.
Yeah, this is obviously a remake of Peter Pan, and it's called Peter Pan and Wendy because you do get much more of Wendy as a character and kind of her perspective and her growth, you know, as much as you get with Peter Pan. And what makes it interesting, too, is David Lowery wrote and directed this. You would know him from The Green Knight a couple of years ago, from Ghost Story, from Eight Dumb Bodies, but he also did Pete's Dragon for Disney a few years ago. So he's one of those directors that to me feels like, okay, you know, I'll give you one type of a director, you know, like I'll do you Pete's Dragon if you let me do a Ghost Story and Green Knight, you know, on your budget. I don't know if that's necessarily how it worked out, but it seems yeah. around that
probably way, like, you know? He does Pete's Dragon to get a nice paycheck to allow him to live for a few years to make a Ghost Story, and then he does a Peter Pan and Wendy so he gets a nice paycheck and then he can live for a few years making things that aren't going to really make money.
Yeah, and I think his touch elevates this a lot, because if you watch The Green Knight, he seems to have this beautiful regard for like the natural world and what colors it can provide. And I think Peter Pan as a character and as an IP also has this like nice regard for the natural world, and he captures the beauty of Neverland in a lot of great ways. And I think he uses color, like in The Green Knight, he uses contrast color so hard. Like there's orange and there's blacks and there's blues, and this kind of does that too. Like when Wendy and her brothers are in London at the beginning of the movie, it's all so dark and dreary and browns and blacks, and like as soon as Peter Pan shows up, it, you know, kind of brightens up, and you get these intercutted flashbacks of Wendy's childhood where it's really bright and really you know, sunlit and everything like that, and the kind of cuts between that and the darker London, you get that contrast, that you get that hint of David Lowery's kind of style in there, you know. And I think as you capture some of the beauty of Neverland, you get that too. But I think what really does hold this back, honestly, is just the fact that it is Peter Pan. Like, beat for beat, it's Peter Pan. And you still have to hit those same beats of, like, oh, here's the bell, or here's the little thumbnail thing. It's like a kiss. And it feels like they had to shove in these things that didn't necessarily need to be in David Lowery's version of Peter Pan. But, yeah, it has that conflict of identity where you see the David Lowery touches that really elevate this thing, and then you also see the Disney Plus touches that bring it back down, you know, especially in the budget. There's never a point where Peter Pan or Wendy are flying around and it looks cool or exciting, you know. It's just kind of them floating around in the sky. Yeah. You know, there's no like Man of Steel flight sequence that would have been awesome to see. I don't know if it's going to be Man of Steel level all the time, but you know, when you have a character who can fly around for the first time, I feel like that should look and feel epic and cool and thrilling. But it's just kind of like a CGI person floating around, you know, in the sky. there's a couple sequences where like, oh, he's climbing around on the wall like Peter Pan rather than like Spider-Man, rather than flying, he's kind of like walking on the ceiling and the walls and that kind of stuff. But they don't do much creatively with the flight, and I feel like that would have really elevated this movie, not to make a pun, but really brought it to new heights, you know.
Not to make another pun, but yeah, so you're saying it's so if you were to rank the live action Disney remakes, this is probably still going to be higher up on your list
then. This is going to be much higher than most of them. I think Jungle Book is probably still number one, but this is biting at its heels, to be honest. If it would have had a little bit more ambition to the plot, like they add to Captain Hook's character quite a bit. They give him a bit more of like a backstory and an origin that I think adds some heart to the story for sure, and some conflict between the characters. You know, you definitely get a better understanding of why does this old man hate this little kid so much? That's kind of weird. You know, why do they have this rivalry between a child and the adult? Obviously, it's thematic, you know, because the whole movie's about not wanting to grow up, and Wendy doesn't want to grow up, so she escapes to this world where she doesn't have to grow up, but she kind of got to learn to grow up, you know? And I feel like that, you know, they could have done more to elevate this movie beyond just a beat-for-beat remake, and they almost do. You know, they get, like, right on the edge of pushing this, but they don't quite push it quite past that line. You know, like, to me, it's like a 3 or like a 3.5 out of 5, which for these movies is a good one. A good score for me.
Yeah. All right, yeah. Probably check it out this weekend. You ready to move on to our big final topic of the day? Well, not our big. Probably.
Yeah, we got a good one to talk about, I feel like, with this one.
Yeah, we do have a comment in the section. Someone commented on Twitch. We didn't need another Peter Pan movie. It won't be better than Hook. Hook, definitely up there. I feel like, to me, the Disney animated version is probably still my number one Peter Pan movie, but Hook's probably number two. We had the Jeremy Sumpter version from the early 2000s, but that movie
was... Is it Maisie Williams version from NBC Live?
Yeah, I'm good on that. I honestly feel like I wish these Disney live action movies weren't remakes, but like, oh, let's tell another side of the story. Like I think it'd be interesting if they were like, oh, this whole movie is going to be kind of the first interaction of Peter Pan and Hook.
Like, yeah, I feel like that's where the perspective to go to. Give us like a Peter Pan prequel or something like that, more than just here's literally the story from before with a few of the plot beats change. And there's a lot of problematic elements to their animated movie of Peter Pan that don't age well into today's society, that are adapted well and change to fit, you know, our modern culture a little bit better. But yeah, if you're gonna watch Peter Pan, throw on the original is my vote.
Yeah, I agree with that. Same with, like I said before, Lion King, and
way better than Lion King though. Don't watch Lion King, watch this.
Yeah, live action. You can watch animated Lion King, I don't care. All right, so you ready to talk about the big topic, and that is the writer's strike?
Yeah, let's get on to the writer's strike. So I have quite a lot written down here for it. So
I'll give my basic understanding of what I've done, some minimal research. And to go back to our comments, someone commented like Wicked was a different story. I feel like that's the approach they should go to with these live action remakes. Don't make the original, like, don't remake Wizard of Oz. Be like, oh, we're going to make Wicked, or, you know, what, like our version of Wicked for whatever
story. Yeah, I could point to Cruella, Disney's own version of doing the same thing. They could have just done, here's 100 or 101 Dalmatians, but again, you know, but they were like, no, let's take a new perspective and like build out this character. People really enjoy the aesthetics of it, but there's not much there. You know, it would have been cool to get a movie all about the Lost Boys or something like that, you know?
Yeah, that would have been cool. All right, so my basic understanding of the writer's strike is essentially, if you don't know, writers, when they write, especially for television, they get residuals. A show, you know, you write on Friends airs basically all day. Somewhere on a channel somewhere, Friends is airing. If you wrote on that episode, you get a small percentage, you get a small amount of money. And obviously, that small amount of money builds up. There's, you know, writers on TikTok who have written for a long time who are like, oh, this is a check I got for $10 for an episode, you know, for King of the Hill, or this is an episode of this. So, you know, $10, $5, sometimes, you know, there's a bar in Los Angeles, I believe, that's called Residuals. And if you give them a check that's made out for no money, you will get a free beer. Like, so you think, oh, the couple cents here and there don't really mean much, but, you know, you get a stack of them, and some of them will be for like $70-$80. You know, that can help pay your rent for the month, that can help support you and allow you to live your life, because it can wind up being a couple $100. But now, essentially with streaming, there's nothing in their contracts to help with that supplemental income, because there is no residuals. If you write for Friends and a million people are watching Friends on Netflix, you see none of that money. Or if you write a show that's just a Netflix original and it's super popular, you see none of that money. Like Vince Gilligan, Breaking Bad got super popular on Netflix and obviously helped launch his career. But anyone who helped co-write any episodes, all those episodes that got super popular on Netflix, they didn't see any money from. And so that's a big part of what this writer's strike is about, is how we as an audience have all moved to streaming, but their contracts, in a way, haven't moved to streaming, and they feel like they aren't getting paid what they should be paid because they're making less now because things are on streaming rather than cable. And then another small part of this is with the massive advancements in AI, you know, like you can go on ChatGPT and be like, I want a script about a fight between James Bond, Batman, and Yoda. And it'll, you know, and you could put it in a style you want. You could put a setting and it essentially can crank out a full script for you. A small part of them is saying we want to basically not allow studios to use like AIs to write scripts. They can use it as a tool. They can use it for this, but they can't just fully replace actual writers with AI models. But Tristan, anything you want to add on top of what I said as just a small explanation for anyone who doesn't know what this writer strike's about?
Yeah, I wrote down, I think the four issues that I think are really holding up this strike and really pushed it beyond the point of getting a resolve. Because people were thinking it might get resolved and not go to the point of a strike, but it definitely is. As of yesterday, hitting the strike. And yeah, I'll go through the two you mentioned first. The residuals is a big one. You know, writers want consistency and transparency from the streamers regarding ratings too, because Netflix and those platforms don't release their viewership. So there's no real way to even argue for residuals because you can't tell if your show is doing good or bad, you know, and residuals are what keep writers afloat when they're not working, you know, and that's another part of the debate here. But yeah, residuals are a big part of keeping people working and afloat in Hollywood. As you know, rent gets bigger and bigger and bigger, people need a way to keep themselves afloat. And if you write something for Netflix that's getting watched, you know, every week consistently over and over and over and over again, I feel like you should get rewarded for that, right? If you write something like, you know, Wednesday, you should be getting residuals for the fact that every single week it's in the top 10, even months after being released. You know, I feel like that's part of what writing for TV should give you. You know, I feel like that's something that is easily to understand from the writer's perspective, but from the streamer perspective, they don't want to release those numbers. It might be a little bit embarrassing to show some of the shows getting weaker numbers than they want people to know about, or they might have to face questions of like, oh, well, this show got this many viewers and this show got this many viewers. Why did you cancel this one or not that one? And you know, those are questions that go beyond like a Twitter answer, you know. So I don't think Netflix wants to take on all of that, you know. I think that's something that is holding up the strikes, especially as they don't want to release their numbers. That's something that I think is really gonna be a debate here, especially because like companies like Netflix that are all streaming are not exactly making cash. This seems like the streaming cash cow is not quite as full of milk as they thought it was, you know. So if they have to start paying residuals on top of what they're already paying people, it might start, you know, milking them dead pretty quick.
Yeah, Netflix's model worked great when they were the only business in town, but I've thought for a while, I think eventually a company is going to come in and buy them, one that already has their own built-in library, whether it is like an NBC Universal being like, okay, Peacock's never really taken off the way we want it to, no one really cares about Peacock. Netflix is a built-in brand. People know what that is. NBC Universal goes in, buys Netflix, basically puts all of their library of content straight on Netflix plus Netflix's content, and then they don't really have to buy as much content or spend money making as much content.
Yeah, Netflix is really on the penny crunching type of thing, you know, and this is not going to be good for them. I'll go into some of the benefits at the end of like why the studios might want have wanted this strike to happen and may have kind of baited it out of the writers. But you mentioned AI, so I'll go through some of the demands from the writers in regard to AI. And the response from the studios to this was, we'll just have an annual meeting to talk about, you know, technology changes. So basically nothing, you know, and it's kind of concerning for people who are worried about AI replacing scripts. It sounds like the studios want that to happen because otherwise they would have a counter for this. But the first demand is that AI can't be used to rewrite scripts, you know. So if David Lowery writes a Peter Pan movie and Disney's like, you know what, we like this, but it needs more action scenes. They can't just go into the AI and be like, okay, add action scenes into this movie, you know. They can't go and do rewrites on already written scripts using AI. They also said that AI cannot be the source material for other scripts. So you can't be like, give me Mario fights Yoda fights Darth Vader, like you mentioned, and then have an actual writer come in and rewrite that. That's also something the writers don't want to have to do. They don't want AI involved at all within the process whenever they can't have it involved, right? And I think the biggest one arguably right here is that Writers Guild written scripts could not be used to train AI. So if you have ChatGPT, you can't go and feed it the script to Barbie as a way of learning how to write scripts, you know, because AI only learns based off of what you give it to learn from, right? So this would make it against WGA protocol to use any WGA scripts as learning fodder for AI. So that would really hold back the development of AI as a script writing tool. And I think that's going to be a big debate of this whole thing.
Yeah, I think the main things that they're like fine with it using for is like research purposes, as far as like typing in, like if they have a script and they're like, this sounds familiar, essentially like using the AI to look up other scripts and make sure like, hey, here's this script. This script isn't identical to something else, is it? Because then it could go and be like, oh, you just basically rewrote Star Wars A New Hope, but replaced the characters or something. I think those are kind of the things that they're fine with the AI using, but not as far as like actually generating content.
And I think a good thing to remember too is that this is only for Writers Guild union members, you know, so a studio could theoretically still release a movie written by ChatGPT or whatever, you know, but they wouldn't be able to credit it to anyone in the Writers Guild. They have to credit it to ChatGPT or to, you know, whatever executive typed in and hit enter, you know.
Yeah, that would be wild. I like, because I know the Russo brothers said, oh, in like 5 years, it's going to be a complete AI-generated movie. I don't think we're going to be at that point, but, I mean, because AI can't even make hands right yet. Like, someone who does a lot of AI art, they can't even get hands right, so I think we're a ways off on a full movie, but I would not be surprised if in, like, 3 to 4 years... Honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if tomorrow someone announced that they are going into production on a movie completely written by AI.
Yeah, I think AI is a huge debate in all forms of art and media right now, and I think it's going to come up in other debates, too. Like, actors are going to want to make sure that, you know, their performance is going to be protected. There was a movie that came out last year called The Climb, where about these two women who got, or like the tower or something, like, I don't remember what it was called. It was about two women who got stuck on the top of a huge, big tower. It was like, you know, Crawl or, you know, 47 meters down, those kind of movies. And they decided to use, it got an R rating for language and some violence. And they decided to use AI to edit the movie down to a PG-13 rating and release it as a PG-13 movie. So there's scenes where like, a woman will say the F word, but the AI will go and kind of edit her mouth and her sound so that it comes out and says frick instead of, you know, the full F word. So it was a really interesting but also a scary prospect of how easy it is to edit small words, can go to larger words, can go to sentences, and all of a sudden you're making whole scenes based off of nothing that was said or done on set. You know, so I'm curious what the debate will be around that as it goes forward. Because, yeah, in this conversation, it's good to remember, too, that the Actors Guild and the Producers Guild are both coming up for negotiations soon. So if this doesn't get resolved in the next few months, you could see a whole shutdown across Hollywood if all of these branches start to, you know, strike at the same time.
Yeah, what would your thoughts be if they did that? If they were like, they came to a medium as far as AI editing movies and they were like, okay, like for the final theatrical version, it's not going to be able to edit movies as far as changing a performance, but for like a broadcast version, where like, you know, you have Yippee-ki-yay Mr. Falcon and Die Hard, but you can clearly see Bruce Willis's mouth doesn't say Mr. Falcon. How would you feel if like they could use AI for at least a broadcast version to like change his lips so at least it comes out as to what he's saying?
But I mean, like, you could do that, right? That's something that I think is a use for AI that's not just stealing someone's job so they don't have to pay somebody, you know? Like, because it all comes down to that. They don't want to have to pay writers. They'd rather have the AI do it than someone write it, you know? And these strikes are a way of showing that without writers, you don't have good scripts. You don't have, you know, good shows. My name is based off of Heroes Season 2 because last time there was a writer's strike, a great, great show with a huge, successful debut season ended up dropping off and going to shit because they didn't have good writers to write good scripts, and the show got pushed back and back, and all of a sudden, you know, the show sucked and nobody watched it. And it was not the only show to go through that at that time. So I would be worried if some of your favorite shows are, like, Abbott Elementary is on halt, Cobra Kai final season is on halt. There's a bunch of shows that are on halt right now, and if they come back with a different writing team that crossed the picket line, or, you know, if Netflix decides, fuck you guys, I'm going to fire the Cobra Kai writing staff, we're going to bring in people who will actually write for us, and all of a sudden the final season is terrible. Yeah. You know, that's a reality that could happen.
Yeah, speaking of reality, last time the writer strike happened, that was the big reality TV boom. Like, there was a little bit of reality TV there. You know, you had your American Idols, your Survivors, Big Brothers, but outside of network TV, there really wasn't much for reality shows. And then the writer strike 2008, 2009 happened, and boom, there's reality shows everywhere. Saw a post this morning that the NBC was looking at canceling The Apprentice. And then the writer strike happened and they needed content. And so they reworked The Apprentice to be Celebrity Apprentice. And that took off like a juggernaut. So, and then, so look forward to Netflix, Amazon Prime, Disney Plus, HBO Max streaming services that really don't have much for reality TV, to start announcing reality TV shows if this thing goes on for a while.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about two of the other big issues there. Oh, yeah. A bit more inside baseball than the other two, but I think are also very important because you have to understand for the majority of writers, they're not hired on as employees of the company, right? Like the people who wrote The Bear are not hired by FX. They're hired as freelancers. They're paid a set amount of money to write a set amount of episodes. And that is clearly not working out financially for people because it's very, very expensive to live in these cities. And a lot of these studios demand that you live in the city that they're working in, despite not providing you, you know, enough money to pay for residence. So, you know, so they say live in LA, but we're not going to pay you enough to live in LA, right? And I think one of the big demands from these studios is they want to be employed through production rather than just be freelancers for a couple of weeks. It wouldn't necessarily be the entirety of the production of the whole series, but it would range from a minimum of 10 weeks to 52 weeks, depending on the length of the show. You know, if you write a network sitcom that's going to be going on for months and months at a time, they want you to be employed as an employee, not as a freelancer, through a good amount of run of that show. And their arguments here are beyond the financial, that having writers stick to a series is how you have showrunners and the feature greats kind of grow. You know, you talk about Vince Gilligan and Damon Lindelof and David Chase and J.J. Abrams, those people who all grew from, you know, a staff writer of a studio to some of the greatest storytellers of TV history. You know, we talk all the time about Felicity and how the writer's room of this random show ended up becoming huge people and influencers of Hollywood. So I feel like part of this is, look, if you want to create the next great generation of TV shows, you got to let writers be on a show, work on a show, mold the show and mold themselves as writers, because that's how you get great writers. And not just the filler writers that I mentioned earlier, where people who are kind of fresh and green that have come in to write something hugely important for a franchise. And all of a sudden it's not that great. And you wonder why, you know, and we mentioned Friends too. It's still one of the most watched shows. And I think that's partially because it kept a good staff of writers around the entire time. People who were able to kind of build those characters. You watch the first couple episodes of Friends and those are not quite the characters you know now, right? And I feel like the reason those characters grew into who they are is because you had a writing team that was there for seasons and seasons on end who were able to kind of find these characters and find themselves within the characters and build that show up to what it is. And if you're just taking writers on for a couple of weeks at a time, you're not having that consistency in the writer's room.
Yeah. So one of the comments we got was basically, are the computer geeks that do AI that much cheaper than writers? And, you know, I messed around with AI before, and I feel like that's the thing, is you don't need anyone that's smart. You literally, a producer themselves could go in there and type. Like when I was messing around, I used up all my free trials, but I just posted, and this will take a minute, but I think it kind of like shows the point of what we're getting at, of how easy the AI makes it. As I just, this was a couple weeks ago, I just posted in there, I need a Batman story in the style of Stephen King. 10 seconds later, this is what it spits out. Gotham City was always a dark and dangerous place, but after the murder of his parents, young Bruce Wayne was haunted by its shadows. He grew to become a wealthy and powerful figure, but his darkness followed him everywhere. One night, while patrolling the city, he stumbled upon a group of criminals plotting a sinister scheme. As he fought them off, he realized that this was just the tip of a much larger and more terrifying iceberg. The Joker, a twisted and evil mastermind, was wreaking havoc in the city, using his diabolical schemes to spread chaos and destruction. As Batman delved deeper into the case, he found himself facing not only the Joker, but also the demons within himself. The more he fought, the more he felt himself slipping into darkness. His obsession with taking down the Joker consumed him, and he began to question his own sanity. Was he really this Dark Knight, or was he slowly becoming the very thing he was fighting against? As the final showdown with the Joker approached, Batman knew that he could no longer fight this battle alone. He needed to come to terms with his trauma and darkness within him if he was going to save Gotham City from Joker's tyranny. In the end, it was not just a battle of good versus evil, but a battle for Bruce Wayne's soul. Would he succumb to the darkness, or would he rise above it and become the hero Gotham needed? Only time would tell. And, like, that's the thing of, like, I just asked for a Batman story in the style of Stephen King, and it spit all of that out. No one could tell a robot wrote that. It was a little generic and vague, but that's also what you get from the free version. I'm sure Warner Brothers, Netflix, Amazon, HBO Max, they all have access to a lot more powerful AI than that.
And that's the thing, though. It does come out like a generic nothing movie without any personal touch. You know, like,
yeah.
It has Stephen King verbiage and stuff in there, but it doesn't have the Stephen King tension. You know, I didn't feel any, like, chills over my spine while you read that. You know, it doesn't have any of the artistic value. And like I said before, AI only grows based off of what you put into it, right? And if this agreement passes, they can have great AI, but if they're not able to feed it scripts to learn how to write a script, it's not going to be able to write a script, you know, and I think that's going to be part of the debate because, you know, do you really want to write a great script for a studio that's just going to be turned around to help fuel your replacement, you know, yeah. in the grand scheme of things?
Yeah.
Another demand for them is, this is more so regarding longer shows, but they want a minimum writer's room of 6 writers that will go up for longer series. And I think that part of this debate is because right now, studios love to do a thing where they have a mini room, not a full writer's room, just a mini room where, like, you know, a couple of, you know, writers will get a little bit of a pay. You know, like I said, they're freelance, not getting paid hourly. They're getting paid a flat rate, no health insurance, no anything like that. They got to pay their own taxes. They're getting this small little payment and say, here, in a few weeks, rush us out a show, you know,
yeah.
Write us a pilot, give us an outline, give us all of that stuff. And they sit there and they bust their asses for huge amounts of hours on and on and on and on and on and on, trying to get this show launched, and with the vague promise of, oh, if it launches, you know, like, maybe you'll be hired on as a writer for the show, maybe, you know, and maybe it won't even launch. You could spend all that time writing a really strong pilot that you believe in and a great outline for months and months on end, and then the studio can be like, you know what, we're going in a different direction, so good luck with the future, and then you're gone. You know, or they could pick it up, it's a great show, and they say, thanks for the pilot and the outline, we'll see you some other time, and then they hand it off to some other writer to butcher or to go win an Emmy for, you know, and that was your show, and now it's not your show anymore. And I feel like they want to go back to the more traditional way of writing. You have a room full of people, and that's your consistent people, at least for, you know, a season at a time, right? And you add that to the demand to be hired through production, and you get more of a consistent writer's room, and I feel like that is going to help shows quality rise too. You can't deny that the writing quality hasn't dropped on a lot of Netflix shows and a lot of network shows and a lot of movies too. And I think having this consistent team that's there, not just there for a couple of weeks to bust their ass and shit out whatever they can get, you know, but a team that owns this project and works on this project, a more consistent team, that's what I think is going to be a good draw for this as an audience member who wants good shows, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Any other demands that they're making? Any other thoughts you have on the strike?
I'm not sure if I don't think the writers are going to sign off to like zero, you know, they're going to want something. So we'll see how long this goes on for, because all of these issues I think are pivotal to both platforms, right? Like the studios don't want to hire you as an employee. You have to pay your insurance and help you with your tax, you know, take your taxes out. That costs them more money than just being a freelance, you know, team. So the studios, of course, don't want to spend money, and the writers are saying, look, we want to be able to live. You know, it's not about us demanding more money. It's about the fact that the cost of living is going up. The demand from the studio is going up, and we want to be able to, you know, afford rent and food while you guys are making billions off of our work. You know, the people at the top of these studios are multiple millionaires off of this work, right?
Yeah. I agree. Definitely a change is needed.
Hopefully. Yeah, it's been a long time coming, and like I mentioned, the Producers Guild and the Actors Guild are both up for negotiations pretty soon. So we'll see, you know, how long this drags out. People were saying, oh, it's only going to be a couple of weeks, but now it's kind of sounding like it might be a little while longer. People are saying, you know, maybe Labor Day, which would be a long strike and a long time of not writing shows, and you're going to start seeing that ripple effect through your shows and your movies.
Yep. We're going to see a lot more delay announcements. You know, if this thing gets resolved in a week, which I doubt, then it'll pretty much be like it never happened a couple months from now. But you might see a lot more reruns and a lot more reality shows and a lot more special event movies airing randomly on like a Wednesday night. Hey, a Wednesday night movies brought to you by CBS. We got Indiana Jones coming out. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, we're going to be airing all the first four Indiana Jones movies before the new one drops on Friday.
Yeah, I want to point out at the end here that, you know, this isn't all bad. It sounds kind of dire. You know, all our stuff is getting delayed. Who knows if stuff is surely going to get canceled. Stuff that's in its infancy is not going to come out. But look, the last time there was a writer's strike, Vince Gilligan had a change of heart and decided not to kill off Jesse Pinkman. And we got one of the greatest characters and the greatest character dynamics of TV history out of it. You know, so maybe there's a writer out there somewhere who's debating some crazy plot twist in their second or third season, and now they're going to not do it, you know. So maybe it'll save us some heartbreak. Maybe, and the reality is, some of these movies and shows could benefit from a delay. It feels like, particularly on the big budget franchise side, things are starting to lack the polish necessary to be, you know, great hits. And maybe this extra time will help those shows out. And most contracts for writers and all people who were hired on for a production, there's a clause that your contract can be null and void in the event of extraordinary circumstances, including a strike. So if they strike for a long enough time, I get to the studios using it as an excuse to end some of their contracts that maybe some of the writers are not quite fond of. Maybe Marvel decides, you know what, this Rick and Morty writer we hired on to boost our multiverse thing, not quite going how we wanted it to go. No. Let's maybe null and void that contract. And it sounds cold, but hey, you know, maybe that'll improve some of the movies, at least. You know, if we want to get some positivity out of that headline, you know, maybe it'll give us some better movies with some stronger writing teams, and people who are paid more are going to work better. You know, are you going to write a great movie when you're worried about, am I going to eat tonight? Is my electricity going to be off when I come home? You know, and I think you're going to get better work out of it ultimately, even if the studio's got to pay up for it.
Yeah, agreed. All right, any other final thoughts before we move on to our last topic?
No, you know, fuck the studios. If support your artists. That's where the real art comes from. The studios put it all together and make it, you know, make it seen by you, but it would be nothing without people who make it happen. You know, the writers, the directors, the actors should all be in solidarity for this, because they're all a unit that move together and make this magical stuff we love so much come to life.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of posts online today about various, like, celebrities out there supporting the writer strike. Rob Lowe was out there marching with them. Jay Leno dropping off donuts for the writers who are on strike. So, with that said, let's move on to our final topic, and that is our MVP of the week. And I think you and I will be on the same page of some version of the writers, the members of the Writers Guild of America MVP of the
week. My MVP, that was the WGA. Got to give them the win, because, like I said, they make this stuff happen. None of these shows would be anything without people writing them, you know, and Joe read an AI story that sounded fine, but that's not going to be one of the greatest Batman stories of all time, you know, and we're going to get the Batman 2, and maybe it just will be. We're going to get the Penguin, maybe it just will be, and that doesn't happen without a writer who has a creative idea for what this can be, you know, and that's why you need artists, because an AI is not going to be creative or ambitious or give you some kind of bold take. It's just going to give you what you ask for, and you might think you want what you ask for, you know, but in the end, that's just going to be us gobbling down whatever easy mode comfort food they're going to give us, and not in any way thinking you're contemplating anything. You know, so that's my feelings on it.
All right, so that said, our MVP of the week is the writers of the Writers Guild of America, and that wraps up our show this week. We will be back next week. If you have any thoughts, questions, recommendations, tweet at us, message us on Instagram at The Hand Plus. That's at THEHANDPLUS. And without further ado, goodbye. Oh, Tristan, final question of the week.
Oh, no.
I always have a random question for you. We got Power Rangers movie. If you could have any kind of 90s nostalgia come back as a movie, what would you pick?
Oh, God, are we going to any 90s nostalgia? Oh, God. See? You got me on that, because I'm much more of a early 2000s nostalgia kind of kid, you know?
I'll give you early 2000s.
But look, okay, we talk about Power Rangers, you talk about, like, toys, you know, that people played with. I have maybe a deep cut toy that I loved a lot as a kid that came out around the same time. Is that it was called Rescue Rangers. He had super-powered police guy who could fly around. He had, like, a firefighter who had a big, powerful, you know, hose. You know, I feel like you could make something cool out of, like, taking these archetypes of characters in the world and just giving them super-powered versions of that thing. You know, that's what I kind of, like, you take the thing and you're like, what if we turn this up to, like, 20 out of 10, you know, just made it a ridiculous version of the thing, you know, and team them up and have them fight kind of some kind of crazy, you know, some kind of crazy CEO who's trying to destroy, you know, the environment, and have them get together and be like, we're going to save the planet and defeat this CEO. I could go for that. Give me that. Give me Rescue Rangers, the show.
All right. My pick was going to be give me a continuation movie of Rocket Power animated. Show me where all the kids from Rocket Power are as adults in modern day.
Yeah, you gave a good answer on that one, Joe. I'd sign up for your show first. You know, I think a Rocket Power revival would be good. Give me another Rocket Power video game. That was a pretty fun video game.
I didn't know there was a video game. So with that, goodbye.